towards the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. Lord of heaven and earth. I get lost in this prayer. The only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. So this is our last day together, and we've been studying this cycle of teachings on the art of personality and training the ego, so to speak, taming and training the ego. And today the subject will be what the ego wants and what the ego needs. So to begin, I'd like to offer this reading from In the Flower Garden of Anayat Khan. We've been reading from this selections ongoingly through these last few days. And this one is, philosophy, which is the fourth stage of development, has five aspects: physical, intellectual, mental, moral, and spiritual. Why do you think he talks about five aspects? Can we relate that to anything else we've learned along the way? The five
elemental breaths?
The five
elements.
Right. Just the elements, the five elements. And you know, I think that this is really wonderful when you're studying and you're practicing, you start to see this recurrence of five. You know, Murshid, we have the symbol of that in our Sufi symbol developed by Hazrat Anayat Khan. And we hear it in the prayer, the morning prayer, yes, until in us be reflected thy grace, thy glory, thy wisdom, thy joy, and thy peace. And one can take into that thy grace, the earth, yeah, thy glory, like either arising, you know, geyser, and also the falling of a tremendous waterfall, thy glory, thy wisdom, illuminated by fire, right? Thy grace, thy glory, thy wisdom, thy joy, the air element, the element of mind, of a creativity, yes? Like the flute, you hear the flute going through the air, yeah? And that peace, the etheric element. Yesterday, Murshid Alauddin read about the circle, and I'm paraphrasing it, but Murshid Anayat Khan, well, those were for selected writings of his as well, but in the Gathas, he teaches us about the circle. That is one of the symbols that he talks about. And he talks about also the Zot, the dot in the circle. And how everything emerges from that. It's almost like the Big Bang Theory, if you think about it, going out in all directions, 360 degrees. And then everything dissolves back into that. And the etheric element is like that as well. Everything unfolds from that element and dissolves back into that element. Thy peace rises and falls, just like this camp. We build, and then we let go. Then we have some space, then we build, and we let go. And just like the breath in our Buddhist practices, the rise of the breath, notice the gap for a moment, the fall of the breath, notice the gap for the moment. So Merchant here is using that number again, five. First is the physical, second is the intellectual, third is the mental, fourth is the moral, and fifth is the spiritual. These cannot be learned by the mere perusal of books and by listening to discussions of philosophers. Why do you think that's true? Why can't it be learned that way? We have vast libraries and have since the beginning of recorded history.
It just sticks in the brain. For me, I always have to take things through.
Yeah.
Form, emotion.
Yeah.
The cells of the body, the wisdom.
Yeah. And that's very much, you know, that's so much of who you are. You take it in, and I think we all do. We take that vibration in. But it's a little bit like the difference of reading a recipe book and eating the food, isn't it? We have to really ingest it. We kind of have to chew it a little bit. Mull it over. Then we swallow it and we digest it. And then we have to let it go too, don't we? We just poop it out. That becomes compost. Yes?
I think we're kind of alluding to this earlier talks, specifically that we were talking about students who, I get it, my mom tell me the next one. They don't ingest it, they don't live it. It just becomes a mental thing.
Yeah, that's a form of spiritual materialism. And that's why I think Murshid Anayat Khan was very wise when he would really only give one practice for the lifetime of a student. Most often that was the case. Very rarely did he change that practice. The other thing that we know that he did was that during summer school gatherings like this, he would have dinners with small groups of students to kind of talk with them. But there wasn't a lot of discourse about stuff. He would, they had what they called samadhi evenings, and he would spend the afternoon at Fazil Manzil in Suren meditating in the Oriental, what's known as the Oriental Room. It's still there. And you see pictures of that in some of the biographical materials. And he would be in such a state that he would, be helped to the meditation hall. And he would sit behind a screen, and one at a time, and the whole summer school would be divided into, and the summer school now went for 3 months there, see. Because people have a much more generous release from their work. So they had the opportunities to do that. And often it was the affluent of the society that were also gathering around him. So, but one at a time, two of Murshid's students would take the arm, hands or arms of a student, and they would be taken below behind the screen and sat before Murshid. And Murshid would have his eyes closed, and he would meditate on that person and also what impression to give to that person, the most highest spiritual ideal impression. And he would open his eyes and he would glance at them for just a few moments, and then he would close his eyes and they would go away. They were taken away. And the people that remember that experience And we're losing now just those last few that remember being with Murshid himself. We still have Murshid Hidayat, thank God. But they talk about that experience as being probably the singular most catalytic experience in their development and in the path. So there's a lot of power without those words. I keep alluding to this to people, and I keep wanting you to understand how many of you are in this circle in one way or another formally. We are, we're lighthouses, and we can radiate and we can connect, whether we're in Colorado or Indiana or Delaware or Ohio or wherever we are. We can connect, we can link up, so to speak. And I would like to ask your ideas now. You don't have to answer me, but I'd like you to give some consideration to the fact that I'm thinking, and Karima Gita kind of just came out of it, what if we did this? This morning she mentioned it, and I said, well, maybe it's in the atmosphere because I've been thinking about it. What if we collectively, like per month, just did a practice together? And that's our practice, and we're like linking up, and we're feeling supported in that practice. I mean, as your spiritual advisor or mentor, I try to, when you're doing your practices, I try to also take those practices into my daily practice. But it comes a lot when you have a lot of people. Sometimes it's just three times, and I'm thinking about, but would that be something you'd like to do? Like collectively, like feel the power and magnetism of doing something as a group? That'd be great. So we can use our Yahoo Near Read Circle and we can communicate. And I really hope that if you have something, and I know some of you have a lot to share, maybe you share your experiences just a little. It doesn't need to be a big narrative or an essay, but, oh, you know, I'm kind of getting this, or this is arising, and it may be some shadow aspect, or maybe some great realization aspect, and is that happening for you? And it's like, that could really be so beautiful and dynamic, because people then have this sangha, you know, that we're sharing with. So anyway, it's just a thought. If you're, if you think that might be a good idea, we could try it, at least till fall camp. For philosophy is not a study which is taught in the universities alone. It contains quite an opposite path to knowledge, and it can only be studied under the guidance of a Murshid. For him, the Murid has a perfect trust and confidence, as complete discipline at the sacrifice of free will is required. At first, this appears to be a loss of individuality. While the ego rebels at being thus crushed and submerged beneath the stronger laws of will and reason. But the battle against the self gives a mastery over self in the end, which in other words is a mastery over the whole universe. But it is well to remember that such utter trust should never be reposed in a Murshid until the self has gained entire confidence in him. And every doubt has to be subdued. When once this confidence is given, there should be nothing on earth which could break or cast it down from the whole gamut of eternity. There are some who consider it most humiliating to be guided by another, but they are greatly mistaken, for in the light of truth there is but one. The intercourse between Murshid and Murid is preferable to any other fellowship in the world. When one considers that a friendship in God is the only true friendship which endureth forever. What do you think about that? Any thoughts? Feelings? reflections?
Stood out to me that was strongly was that in an earlier part of the passage about the mastery of yourself, which in other words is mastery of the whole universe. That seems like an endlessly unfolding concept.
Okay, anything else? I think Mershad is highlighting here something that is probably very difficult for us in the West, and that's the path of discipleship. I hope you can understand that some things are said without being said. This is from some collective interviews, and I try to explain this, especially when someone hasn't been to the class. I'm creating the setting for the gem to come. Okay, so I'm sort of kind of trying to set that atmosphere by highlighting these different teachings by Mershad. And this was we have some wonderful opportunities to have recordings of questions and answers between his students at summer school and himself. And this is a few of those questions, and you'll see, I think, how they relate. And I think that in this first one, I was a very good example, a good bad example this morning, or this just a few minutes ago. So you can use me as your bad example. Should the eyes always be open? This is about prayer. Yes. One day I told the children that the children used to close their eyes at the dinner table when the prayer is said. So now he's talking about Nora-Nisa and Vilayat and Hadayat and Clara-Nisa. Yes, one day I told the children that the children used to close their eyes at the dinner table when the prayer is said. I said, why is this prayer said? Prayer is said for Thanksgiving, for dinner. The best thing you can do should be looking at it. But that was for the children. The idea is that our eyes must pray at the same time. So here he's saying, keep the eyes open. And myself, I had my eyes closed when I started to say the towards the one, and I get so sometimes so inwardly drawn I forget the words. You see, in one way we want to feel intimate, but in another way we can get lost in that. It's good to be awake. Why must they, meaning the eyes, be deprived of praying? The opening of the eyes is right, because then a person is normally awake. If the eyes are closed, then you do not know if a person is asleep or awake. Just look before one and yet not bend the head. So he's saying, just look, you know, not like this. And we get really used to that. Let's bow our head in prayer. Right? But Mershad was very, this is maybe a little bit like the sun, really directed towards the one. And here I was, towards the one. Where is it? Okay. Another question. Mershad, is it not better not to do the movements too strong? Okay, he's talking about the movements of the prayer, but this could be extrapolated out to other things. And he says, Mershad's answer is, yes, that is quite true. One must do it softly and easily, not too hard, because that shows the hardness of the character if one does them hard. One must make them soft. Can you explain the movements to people when they ask, or can we? And he said, yes, you may. And here, you know, there was a prelude. There was a, it was about zikr and also about the prayers as well. And this is what I'm trying to get to, is this one question and answer. So this is the build-up. Okay. Will you please say once more that from the heart I surrender, from the left side heart and the right side soul? Murshid's answer. The mystic have considered right side the soul and the left side the heart. The seat of the heart. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Then the question comes after that. Must we make the cross from left to right or right to left? Answer. Cross made from left to right. That right is perfection. Left is imperfection. I am going from limitation to perfection. La elaha el alahu. You see? It was interesting, I was noting, it was either the first or second night, and Halima was leading a three-part zikr. And at the center were sitting individuals doing the spoken zikr. There was only one person that I noticed making that movement. And do you know who I'm talking about and who she was trained by? Were you there too?
I was there.
Okay, then you were doing it, but there was one other person that I didn't see. Uh-huh. You weren't in my view. But you know this message. You understand this movement.
I can too.
Yeah. And Sadi also talks about that movement, and he talks about it so beautifully. I remember he was visiting us in Kansas City, and he said, that's not a rough movement, you know. He's very he's always very fluid and very beautiful in his gestures. And he said, you imagine that you're sweeping and making a cup in the heart to receive the divine light. You know, it's like this beautiful gesture, you know. But here's the esoteric meaning, the meaning that the mystics concentrate on. I'm moving from limitation to perfection. From imperfection to perfection. And, well, then back again. Yes?
I like the image of the tarnished heart. And then when you sweep,
yes,
each time you sweep a little bit of tarnish. And one time you talked about little paintbrushes on the end of your chin. And each time you sweep, a teeny tiny bit of that tarnish goes. And by the end of your life, hopefully, all the tarnish goes.
And just to give a little, because that's kind of an odd, you know, when we say clearing the rust away from the mirror of the heart, I mean, the mirrors of this day, how they don't get rust on them. They get smudges and dust. But, in the days before, the only way that we could have those reflective surfaces was perhaps in a stilled lake, but also the metalsmith would take metal And finally, well, here we go. First, they would take the raw material and they would put it into the fire to soften it. Like the chickpea staying in that pot. And then they would take that molten material and form it. Here's the work of the merchant, so to speak. Form it in the image that they wish to fashion it in. But it was perhaps to the liking of a customer, let's say. An individual. It was suited for a particular individual, this form. And then they'd have to sometimes tap, 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 just to refine it, get it into shape. Well, sometimes a little bit harder. And then the polishing. And with that, there was the reflection that could come through or radiate. It's an important metaphor, clearing the rust away from the heart. What does that mean? It comes from this long tradition of how this process is taken and made something, this rough substance can be made into something beautiful that reflects everything back to the world. It's a very wonderful metaphor. And sometimes then if it's not kept in the right environment, well then it can get a little rust and tarnish on it, can't it? Last question and answer. Murshid, would you please explain the difference between mantra and prayer? Anyone want to take a guess at the answer?
A mantra evokes a quality, and a prayer is actually a communication.
Well, here's Murshid's answer. And that's also true. And here's Murshid's answer. Prayer and mantra are the same. Only some mantras are so short that it is only one word. But it is like a prayer. One might say it is a sacred word instead of calling it a prayer. But really speaking, both are the same. We know that. In fact, you probably know, so excuse me if I'm telling you something you're well schooled on. In Tibetan Buddhism, they have very complex, very long text. For example, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, Prajna being wisdom, and Paramita are, it's like the heart, the sutras, okay, the wisdom of the heart. And it goes on, and at the end it's distilled to these words. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. So when you say that mantra, it is infused with the entire sutra. And in that way, each one of the mantras, I know at least in Tibetan Buddhism, and I suspect in other traditions as well, is a distillation of this more complex text. And it's true with the Tara mantra, Om Tare Tutare Tue Soha, the very long complex text to the 21 Taras, but it's this then distillation. So it's as if you're saying the entire text with this mantra. It's interesting, I have to say, the other day Rahim said, I don't know what we were talking about, it was something like buying indulgence. Oh, is that like buying indulgences where you can ask you can ask the church to pray for you, or you know. And in Buddhism, in or at least in India where I was with the Tibetan Buddhist monks, that's part of the way they raise money. Because families will, they might, maybe a family goes to a lama for some sort of divination or advice, and the Lama will say, well, it would be very good to do 100,000 whatever. And you know, it's like, what householder could possibly do that? So they hire the monks to come to their homes where they all have some sort of semblance of a temple room, and then the monks do that for several days for them. So the, yeah, the, they do that too. They buy indulgences as well.
Do you think it works?
Yeah. I'm sure of it. Why do I think that works? You know, and Karimi Gita knows this, she was there with me in India. I had a very radical experience. Some of you know about it. I talked a little bit yesterday when Guruji sensed that that experience had taken me to maybe even across the threshold of death. And I know that there were monks and nuns that were coming and doing prayer and kind of making offerings, you know. And, well, I'm here.
Well, it kind of breaks down that individual thing.
It does.
Like, really, why can't this person say prayer? Because they're not really a separate person.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Everybody in the room can enjoy the light, even though they weren't the ones to turn on the switch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is also important. No candle burns less bright for having lit another. No candle burns less bright for having lit another. So in the beginning we did the practice of a variation, you would say, because the tempo was very different, of Murshid Hazrat Inayat Khan's zikr. And he has, there is a document that has been discovered in the archives that he gives, of course, the musical notations of the zikr, and he has written about it where he says, if done for 6 weeks straight, the zikr, it will cure one of all obscurations of the mind and depression. And also, if you feel in your lives that your things are a little too hectic, overwhelming, impinging on you some way, you know, there's a pressure. You know, what happens is energetically or emotionally, because we have these different bodies too that correspond to the different elements, things can create a compression in us. And if you've ever cooked with a pressure cooker, you know what happens if the pressure isn't released appropriately, right? I mean, it's actually very dangerous. So, I had asked Murshid Hidayat, because I sometimes have this energetically, which can also create, you know, some physical issues. And he said, the stretch breath, which all of you should know, and it's in the yellow practice manuals that I think most of you have, and the zikr of Inayat Khan are the best things to cure this, because with the zikr of Inayat Khan, he always emphasizes that Murshid called it the gentle singing zikr. You can see that some zikrs are intended to excite people, but this one is intended to be very gentle and kind of integrate things. So Murshid Hidayat told me that by doing this zikr, even silently, hearing the music internally, the harmony of the zikr, that then you circulate this energy even as much as like the vibration goes into the blood and the lymphatic system and circulates through the entire body and gets distributed. So it's very practical. Very practical. So Murshid again talks about the left side as being that limited self. One could say our individuated self. And the right side being this unlimited, perfect self. And you know, I've heard many explanations why we hug each other on two sides, but this is probably the best one ever. We're honoring each other's hearts and we're honoring each other's soul. And isn't it easy to then think about it? When we're hugging this way, we're touching each other's hearts and we're remembering each other's souls. You know, it's very interesting to think about these subtleties, what's really happening, and bring that into our consciousness and our awareness. So, for just a few moments, let's ask you to look. Murshid Inayat Khan in his writings talked about the directions of the breath. This is also exemplified in the purification breaths and in the elemental breaths. But here what we're going to do is we're going to use an exhalation as we move from left to right. And an inhalation as we move from right to left. And as we sweep from left to right, we think of offering all of that which has been individuated to the unitive self that unites with all in the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. And as we exhale, inhale, from right to left, we draw upon that perfection in forming this individuated, limited self. And when we breathe out from left to right, again we surrender, offering this limited self to the perfection of the One. And as we breathe out from right to left, we bring the knowledge of that One into the individuated self, the limited self. And on the ficker, you may want to, ficker meaning a phrase on the breath, you could say La ilaha el Allahu, but how about this? There is nothing moving from left to right. There is nothing. And moving from right to left, only God is. And breathing out from left to right, there is nothing. And breathing in from right to left, only God is. And just do this for a little while on your own rhythm, on your own natural breath. But this act of surrender, Fana, surrender, annihilation, offering the individuated self on the altar of the One Self. And bringing this beautiful gift of the knowledge of the one self into the individuated self. Always keeping the line of communication between this, the heart and the soul, open. And remember to breathe out from left to right and in from right to left. There is nothing. Even I dissolve. There is nothing. Only God